Advances in gynecologic endocrinology, diagnosis of ovulation, management of secondary amenorrhea, thyroid and adrenal therapy for menstrual dysfunction, and management of the climacteric are the featured topics on this issue of Audio Digest Obstetrics and Gynecology, Volume 15, Number 13. What is the best way to detect ovulation? In answering this question, our first guest lecturer, Jefferson Medical College's Alvin F. Goldfarb, comes up with a number of direct and indirect methods useful in diagnosis. Dr. Goldfarb?
The first one I'll talk about is truly historical facts and historical factors. When one takes a menstrual history, if one will take the time to find out whether or not, A, the individual has cyclic symptoms, is there premenstrual breast mastalgia, is there headache, is there abdominal distension, and are there changes in personality? Are there attacks of hunger in the middle of the night where the lady gets up and actually goes down to eat something because she's having cyclic changes in glucose metabolism? These type of cyclic phenomena give indirect evidence that perhaps there is ovulation, perhaps. Or does the lady have primary dysmenorrhea, an indirect index that she may or may not ovulate? And does she have cyclic bleeding at mid-cycle? Does she have spotting and staining in association with Mittelschmerz? Is there a physical phenomena associated with ovulation that she complains about? Is the individual one that has a progesterone allergy? I have seen patients, and we are still seeing patients, that develop apthostomatitis on a cyclic basis. I have seen patients with polyarthritis on a cyclic basis, erythema nodosum on a cyclic basis. And when we block ovulation in these patients, these cyclic phenomena disappear. So just by talking to the patient, one can get some idea as to whether or not she truly does ovulate, indirectly speaking. One can use the basal body temperature chart. Now, we must go on record as saying that we do not expect our patients to become addicted to a BBT. We don't want an infertility patient to get so fixed on this chart that's all she thinks about. We use it as a screening device. 2 to 3 cycles worth of study will give us the information we need. Now, if the lady has an ovulatory defect associated with luteal phase abnormality, she can have 2 variations. She can have a sharp rise, looking like it's an excellent ovulation, and boom, 7 days later, the temperature chart falls off. Those of you who have worked with clomiphene tend to see this type of temperature chart in the first to second clomid-treated cycle, where they get a short corpus luteum phase as we begin to rev up ovarian function. Or else one can see what is called a staircase type chart, the slow rising chart lasting 12 to 14 days, never showing a good dip or a good rise. And in my opinion, this type of chart indicates poor corpus luteum function. If we are not treating the patient endocrinologically and we've established ovulation, we throw them out. We don't want this lady to become addicted or fixed on a temperature chart and become a schizoid about it. Now, vaginal cytology. One can use vaginal smears to evaluate ovulation, but you can't use one smear. Let's get that straight. I'll challenge anyone to say that a lady is ovulated by looking at one vaginal smear. One must take a serial determination of vaginal smears to evaluate whether or not the individual ovulates. Then you'll say, well, you've heard me say that I use vaginal smears all the time. Yes, I use them for one purpose only, all the time. The next organ system that we come in contact with is the cervix. And the cervical mucus is secreted from the endocervical glands as a function of estrogen. The cervical mucus is secreted from the endocervical glands as a function of estrogen. And this can be blocked completely by progesterone, so that one can describe a monophasic type of curve with reference to certain properties of cervical mucus, which are used to evaluate ovulation. And here again, one cannot use one smear. One must study the cervical mucus on at least 2 occasions, preferably 3, spaced throughout the cycle. And cervical mucus, as you know, consists of proteins and electrolytes. And under the influence of estrogen at mid-cycle, the endocervical glands secrete copious amounts of cervical mucus, which have good protein and electrolyte content. And if you allow proteins and electrolytes to dry, they have a particular physical characteristic. And the crystallization of cervical mucus occurs, which is known as ferning, or palm leaf, or arborization. And this particular quality of cervical mucus, when drying to crystallize, is used as an index of estrogenic function. It is not used as an index of ovulation. But if this lady has a fern on day 13 of the cycle, and she returns to your office on day 20 of the cycle, and the fern has disappeared, one can then say somewhere between day 13 and day 20 of the cycle, ovulation may have taken place. So that one has to use two cervical mucus studies. Now, that's one of the characteristics of cervical mucus that is exciting and translates into studies of ovarian function on a cyclic basis. But there are other physical properties. And the elasticity, the tensile strength of cervical mucus is also under the influence of estrogen. And the spinbarkite increases as one approaches mid-cycle and ovulation. And then when progesterone appears, the spinbarkite disappears. But in contradistinction to tensile strength, one notes that the viscosity changes. As the cervical mucus becomes more watery at mid-cycle, the tensile strength is greater, and that as it becomes thicker and more viscous, the tensile strength gets less. The quantity of cervical mucus increases under the influence of estrogen, and the cervical mucus becomes acellular. On the day of ovulation, one would expect to find watery cervical mucus with no cells in it. And the most important property, sperm survival, reaches its peak at the time of ovulation. The alteration in cervical mucus under the influence of microdose progestin therapy is now being evaluated as a second-generation oral contraceptive, wherein we will not inhibit ovulation, but with microdoses of progestins, we will alter cervical mucus so that sperm will not survive. This is in preliminary study by our group and from its physiologic standpoint. Now, we can proceed further up the reproductive tract and do an endometrial biopsy. And we can tell exactly how many days post-ovulatory an individual is depending upon the histologic appearance of the glands and the histologic appearance of the stroma. And the glands have subnuclear vacuolization early in the luteal phase. At about mid-luteal phase, the vacuoles become epinuclear and extrude their content into the lumen of the endometrial gland so that foodstuff is there for that fertilized egg when it gets down. And as the cycle progresses, the endometrium becomes premenstrual, regressive, blood vessels become prominent, and the surrounding cells around blood vessels undergo predecidual changes, so that we can use the endometrial biopsy in the post-ovulatory stage to evaluate whether or not a lady is ovulated. If only being interested in ovulation and not interested in the whole process of implantation and nidation, that probably the simplest time to take your endometrial biopsy would be within the first 12 hours of the onset of menses. If you're interested in human reproduction, on the other hand, we can then get into a debate as to when the proper time to take an endometrial biopsy is. I, for one, do all my biopsies on day 22 and 23 of the cycle when I'm dealing with an infertility problem. If I'm just interested in whether the lady is ovulating or not, premenstrual endometrial biopsy is fine. Now, most recently, we feel the evaluation of ovulation also can be carried out by direct visualization of the gonad through the colposcope. And colposcopy is of importance to us in the evaluation of ovulation to see whether or not, A, one can see a stigma, whether or not there's a corpus luteum present. Now, you can't see the whole ovary through the colposcope. Let's get that straight. All you can see is the surface that is not attached to the mesovarium and not bound down into the posterior sheath of the broad ligament. so that you may look in and say, oh, I see no evidence of ovulation on colposcopy, but that does not mean that this lady has not ovulated. But if you do see a corpus luteum or you do see a stigma, well, then you've got pretty good evidence on direct visualization that ovulation did take place in this individual. More recently, direct visualization of the pelvic viscera has found a group of new enthusiasts. And these enthusiasts are interested in a diagnostic procedure called peritoneoscopy. And the Europeans were the ones that revived our interest in this, especially the Scandinavian group of workers, wherein under general anesthesia, below the navel, just to the midline, you take a trocar and you puncture into the peritoneal cavity, introduce 1,500 cc's of CO2, and look at the pelvis. Now, if I've got a peritoneoscope patient, I think I'd just as soon make the incision a wee bit longer and do something definitive at the same time. Because if I can't colposcope a lady, and this is debatable, because of a fixed retroverted uterus and she's got an infertility problem, well, I better get a look inside anyway and do some definitive surgery. We can debate this point. So direct visualization is another method of evaluating whether or not an individual ovulates. Someone I know is going to ask me, well, Goldfarb, what's the best method for evaluating ovulation in your opinion? And rather than be facetious, I will not say pregnancy, but in my hands, I find that I can get the most information in our laboratory setup at Jefferson and my clinical background by doing a combination of basal body temperature charts and a urinary pregnandiol. Now, I'm sure that there are members of this audience who say, no, I use an endometrial biopsy. But I will challenge you unless you read your own biopsy, because the pathologists are not interested in endometrial tissue. They are not interested in dating it. Please learn to date them yourself.
Jefferson's Roy G. Hawley raises a question pertinent to this discussion, with Dr. Goldfarb and Vanderbilt University's Donald Goss responding.
Clomiphene citrate therapy has been recommended for 3 cycles only. Have you used it longer, or offer a resting interval, especially when one has presumptive evidence of ovulation but no fertilization?
That question was just posed recently to a group of us, and I went on record as saying that A, if conception does not take place after 3 treatment cycles, one must look for other causes of infertility before saying that the individual is a clomid failure. B, perhaps there should be alteration in dosage. We have many patients who we use a much higher dosage level than that recommended by food and drug. But I wouldn't suggest that everybody use elevated doses of clomid, because you do run into the problem of ovarian hyperstimulation. I would think, and I will say that I personally will colposcope these patients who don't get pregnant after 3 clomid treatment cycles. And I'm wondering whether or not we shouldn't colposcope most of these patients before we put them on clomid to make sure there's no abnormality in the ovum transport mechanism before using clomid.
I feel that the infertility patient that by history and your first visit examination appears to be an ideal candidate for clomiphene should not receive clomiphene just after that initial visit. I think you're obligated to work the patient up with a complete infertility workup, not measuring 17 ketones and hydroxys necessarily and so forth, but making sure that they do have an anovulatory pattern, making sure that they have patent tubes before you place them on this drug, making sure the husband's sperm count is okay, if only by the simple means of a postcoital examination. The other thing I would urge people to do is that if you have a clomiphene failure in a patient who you know is a failure to ovulate, not necessarily a failure for conception, clomiphene failure, a patient who does not ovulate, who you think should ovulate, she has some estrogen effect, you maybe get total gonadotropins and they're within normal limits, I would hardly recommend you follow this patient very carefully for the possibility of a pituitary tumor. Quite to the contrary of an article that appeared last month, it has been my experience that patients with early pituitary tumors, 3 of them before evidence of pituitary tumor by a Celotersica examination, but who had early defects in their visual fields, these patients did not respond to clomiphene, although they had normal, quote, total gonadotropins by bioassay, and on radioimmunoassay had low levels. So that I do think that clomiphene may be, in that patient who is developing a pituitary lesion, may be an index of pituitary reserve. Because really we know that Clomiphene lets us know if the pituitary can release LH.
Thank you, gentlemen. Noting that a patient with secondary amenorrhea is difficult to evaluate, particularly when a clinician has a vast battery of tests from which to choose, Duke University's C.D. Christian finds that by utilizing a practical, step-by-step method, the diagnostic workup can be simple and successful. This is how Dr. Christian evaluates the problem.
When you first see the patient, you can learn a great deal, I think. One, the cervical mucus, and you're all aware of the ferning pattern and the spinbarkite and the things that can be learned from it. And this is just reflexly done and does not add any time to your pelvic examination. A cornification count or maturation index, if you prefer to call it that, can be done, of course, very readily. An endometrial biopsy is, of course, of ultimate help and can usually be obtained on the first visit. Now, because most of these patients are referred and are there for a couple of days only, I go ahead and collect 17 ketosteroids and hydroxycorticosteroids and gonadotropins, and usually do one assay of thyroid function, either a PBI or a column thyroxin. Now, after this initial work is done and you have your biopsy in the state the patient presents in, I find that a progesterone provocation is a very valuable thing, and I still like to use intramuscular progesterone in oil. 100 milligrams usually will suffice. And then follow the patient depending on what the progesterone effect was. Let's say she had normal ketosteroids and hydroxys and that she had no uterine bleeding when you gave progesterone. Then you would have to wonder several things. You'd have to maybe look more closely at the uterus. Maybe this is a patient who you could not get an endometrial biopsy on or couldn't sound at the time, of course, and then you'd be concerned about Asherman syndrome or uterine synechia if you prefer, and this is a situation you know where the connective tissue tends to occlude most of the uterine cavity in its attempt to proliferate and heal an endometrial cavity, usually following a dilatation and curettage in a puerperal state for postpartum bleeding, for instance, where you're, of course, very concerned to try to get all of the retained secundines that may be present, and you consequently denude the myometrium, literally, and end up with uterine synechiae. It can also be seen, of course, following septic abortions and other occasional situations. Endometrial atrophy, of course, we might find following a hematometra of any kind. For instance, an overvigorously cauterized cervix might result in cervical stenosis in 2 or 3 months of hematometra, and you will probably end up with an atrophic endometrium as well as a cyclically ill and painful patient. Endometrial tuberculosis we don't think much about in this country, but certainly endometrial tuberculosis will leave a granulomatous type reaction in the endometrium and will cause amenorrhea. Now, if the uterine exam is normal, then we might want to look back and see what our PBI data is. And again, if the PBI is normal, it is possible that we have a unitropic failure, gonadotropins decrease at all. I think this is very rare, to be quite honest, although it's popular right now to talk about unitropic failures. I don't think we very often see someone who doesn't have underlying central nervous system pathology who just drop out gonadotropins only and not have the other tropic hormones also affected. Of course, a functioning pelvic tumor might decrease the pituitary gonadotropins, but hopefully this would have been noted on physical exam or some other indications, such as virilization, if it were a virilizing tumor, and it would almost have to be if she presented as amenorrhea. Again, you might find a situation where the patient has elevated gonadotropins and has had secondary loss of sexual characteristics, such as in a premature ovarian failure, idiopathic, if you will, premature ovarian failure, or the occasional triple X female or the triple XXO female mosaic, who will, of course, pubesce normally, usually have more or less normal periods for a period of time, may even reproduce, but then usually will get early ovarian failure. If the patient has a low PBI, of course, we'd again be concerned about the gonadotropins, and if they're absent, and then we also find that the other tropic hormones are absent, of course, we would be concerned about a hypopituitary state. Now, it is possible in hypothyroidism, of course, with a low PBI, to also have relatively low gonadotropins. And gonadotropins are not that sensitive to be able to detect small differences. And there are fluctuations from day to day. But people with hypothyroidism frequently will have lower than normal gonadotropins. So it might lead us to this diagnosis. It is true, however, that most patients with hypothyroidism will present as menometrorrhagia and not secondary amenorrhea until the point they get so frankly myxedematous that it's rather obvious anyway, as opposed to the hyperthyroid patient who will usually present with amenorrhea and not menometrorrhagia. Now, you have to add that either one of these thyroid aberrances may present either way as amenorrhea or menometrorrhagia, but generally hyperthyroid patient, the Graves' disease, will present with amenorrhea, and the hypothyroidism patient, or myxedema, or Gall's disease, will present with menometrorrhagia. I don't quite know where to put post-pill amenorrhea. I think we are certainly seeing this more and more. We've started collecting some patients and have somewhere in the mid-20s now referred patients. I think Dr. Goldfarb probably has an equal number, or maybe twice as many. But we are seeing women who, coming off of the pills, indeed have amenorrhea for prolonged periods of time, 2, 3 months, 6 months, 18 months, and so on. And this is a problem. In most of the patients that we've followed, we find some other underlying pathology, such as hypothyroidism, or a diabetic patient previously undiscovered. What this all means, I think we don't know. And this is what we have to determine by looking at all these various patients we're collecting. I think there certainly is this risk, anytime we use the pills, that a patient may become amenorrheic following them for a period of time. What we don't know is, who is this population that's at risk? How do we define them? Who are the girls we should not give the pills to? And in general, if you look back historically, of course, you'll find that the ones who have post-pill amenorrhea are the ones who spotted and sputtered around with their periods anyway. They were never regular. They had prolonged intervals beforehand, and so on. Sometimes you think of these as maybe the more sensitive souls, you know, the same girls that have 3 months of amenorrhea when they go to Europe, or when they're in a baton twirling contest in high school, or any other stress situation like this. And it may possibly be that these girls are just a little more easily suppressed than some of the others. But in any event, I think we have to be concerned about post-pill amenorrhea. Clomiphene has been a lifesaver in these patients as far as something to do to get them to ovulate afterwards. Before clomiphene were available generally, this was indeed a problem. The other practical thing that I like to do is ask all the patients who do want to take the pills to stop, and I tell them it's just an idiosyncrasy of mine, and I really can't give them a good reason for it. But I'd like for them to stop taking the pills every year, or certainly year and a half, and wait until they have one bleeding episode on their own, or two if they will. Most of them won't wait. And this does, I think, a couple of things. It at least lets us pick up this patient. If she were going to be a post-pill amenorrhea, then we would pick it up after only a year or 18 months of taking the pills, rather than after 2 or 3 or 4 years of taking the pills. This way she would know, and you have a little hard time talking them into it at first, but if they look over their calendar, they'll find some month that their husband's going to be away for a week or two, or they're going to be home visiting mother and with the children, and they can use some other means of contraception. They don't want to do it when they're on the pills and they're working successfully for them, of course, but usually after they do it one time, you don't have any trouble getting them to do it again, because it's rare that she'll click off a 28-day period, of course, after the pills. Statistically, she's going to wait at least 35 to 40 days before she has that first period when she stops the pills. And this alone will usually make the point to the patient that something has been going on to her cyclic mechanism, and the fact she doesn't bounce right back with a 28 to 30 day period will usually make this point so that it's easier to get her to stop in the future, I find. Let's assume this patient did have bleeding after progesterone provocation. What sort of things would we be concerned about? Again, a PBI might be indicative of some thyroid aberrance. We might want to get more thyroid tests, and we might find that she has a moderate degree of thyroid impairment in either direction, which had caused her amenorrhea. Again, we might find an adnexal mass, but hopefully we would have found this beforehand, and ordinarily a feminizing tumor will not cause amenorrhea, although occasionally they may give fairly long period of amenorrhea because of constant estrogen production in high amounts. Now, of course, we again, if we should happen to pick up any visual field defects or neurologic defects, of course, be concerned still about a central nervous system tumor or a pituitary tumor, because certainly they don't all present with galactorrhea. Then we come to probably the largest group, and that known as anovulation of unknown etiology. Everything is normal except they have long periods of time during which they don't ovulate and they're not having periods. And of course, this was the bane of our existence until clomiphene became available to us. Then of course, you may have a patient who has what we in Durham call a mystic cystic syndrome, because we try to honestly admit we don't understand it. It's otherwise known in Philadelphia as a polycystic syndrome, Stein-Leventhal syndrome, sclerocystic ovary syndrome. We call it mystic cystic because it is just that, and about the time we think we know something about it, we find we really don't. But in general, of course, if the patient has amenorrhea, infertility, bilaterally enlarged ovaries, these are the things that would comprise the Stein-Leventhal syndrome as described in 1935. Of course, she may not have enlarged ovaries. She may have normal-sized ovaries and still have an early polycystic ovary syndrome. One of the more difficult ones is the anorexia nervosa type patient. There's a long-standing clinical rule that John Eager Howard at the John talks about, and he says that in making the difficult differentiation between Simmons disease or hypopituitarism or Sheehan's and anorexia nervosa, because frequently the laboratory findings will be very much the same in these patients. If a patient has laboratory findings of hypopituitarism and they're sick and they're in bed and they can't do their work and they can't get around, that's hypopituitarism. If the patient has the same chemistries and she is up and about doing her work, and by the way, these girls are usually very obsessive compulsive people. They keep very neat rooms. They work hard in school. They work hard around the house. They drive themselves and everyone else in the family. But they keep going with these same bad laboratory findings. That's anorexia nervosa, and it generally works that way.
Thank you, Dr. Christian. And this, doctor, is the end of this side of your reel. The remainder of this issue may be heard by reversing the two reels or cassette cartridge on your tape recorder. This is Side B, Audio Digest Obstetrics and Gynecology, Volume 15, Number 13, the continuation of a review of recent advances in gynecologic endocrinology. Turning now to diagnosis and treatment of thyroid and adrenal disorders. Abnormalities of thyroid function can be reflected in derangements of sexual maturation, ovulation, and menstruation. Jefferson Medical College's Ronald E. Traum now discusses some helpful guidelines in managing gynecologic problems resulting from thyroid dysfunction.
In the patient with hyper or hypothyroidism, gynecologic symptoms are not infrequently an integral part of the clinical picture. In the patient with thyroid disease, the management of the associated gynecologic disorder becomes, of course, a matter of the treatment of the underlying thyroid abnormality. The thyrotoxic patient, for example, with scant periods or amenorrhea, usually experiences a prompt return to a normal menstrual flow as soon as effective antithyroid therapy is established. the administration of thyroid hormone to the hypothyroid patient with an associated menstrual disturbance or in ovulatory infertility usually results in prompt return of normal reproductive function. The effects of thyroid therapy in the anovulatory hypothyroid patient are often so dramatic that unfortunately it was this that gave strong support to the popular but completely unwarranted conclusion that a minor degree of thyroid insufficiency is a common cause of sterility or impaired fertility. And on the basis of this assumption, it became a common practice to empirically administer thyroid extract to infertile women when no definite cause for their infertility could be found. The truth is that hypothyroidism is an extremely uncommon cause of infertility or menstrual dysfunction. In 100 consecutive cases of anovulatory infertility reviewed in our private practice, only 3% of the patients exhibited clear evidence of associated hypothyroidism. And this is very close to the experience of other clinicians. Some authors do report, however, a higher incidence of hypothyroidism in adolescent females with menstrual dysfunction. I think this is a point to keep in mind. Dr. Behrman, who most of you know at the University of Michigan, reviewed a large series of cases, and he noted an approximate 40% incidence of hypothyroidism in a group of adolescents with menstrual dysfunction as compared to only a 3% incidence, again almost identical to our own, in a group of similar patients who are over 21, again demonstrating that it is more common among the adolescent. However, the conclusion is still obvious. Hypothyroidism is an extremely uncommon etiologic factor in gynecologic disorders. Despite this, if the empirical administration of thyroid hormone had a beneficial effect in correcting disturbed pituitary ovarian function in the euthyroid individual, then its use might still be justified. Several critical studies, however, have failed to produce objective evidence that this treatment has any worthwhile effect. Moreover, it is an undesirable practice for several reasons. First, and probably most important, the premature use of thyroid may supplant adequate study of the infertile patient. As a result, a significant defect may be overlooked and its correction delayed. Secondly, the neurotic patient may report an initial benefit, which is interpreted as a favorable clinical response. As the therapy is continued, however, some of these individuals actually become habituated to thyroid and feel they cannot live without it. It is not uncommon to see patients who are placed on small doses of thyroid empirically during early adolescence because of a minor menstrual irregularity and who have been taking it continuously for some 10 or 15 years by the time you see them. Third, excessive doses of thyroid may actually cause symptoms of hyperthyroidism, such as tremors, sweats, extreme nervousness, and palpitations. Some patients who are more sensitive than others to thyroid may suffer premature systoles and other cardiac arrhythmias with even relatively small doses. In addition, by disrupting normal pituitary ovarian function, fertility may actually be decreased. Finally, iatrogenic hypothyroidism may follow the withdrawal of thyroid. The administration of thyroid hormone, of course, to a euthyroid individual inhibits the individual's TSH, suppressing the production of his own thyroid gland. Exogenous thyroid hormone then merely replaces endogenous thyroid hormone. If the dose is not large, the initial hypermetabolic effect soon returns to normal as the individual's own thyroid gland becomes suppressed. When thyroid therapy is discontinued, however, the suppressed thyroid gland often requires at least 2 to 4 weeks to resume normal function. If this interval is prolonged, the patient may actually become temporarily hypothyroid. And to the physician who is unaware of this effect, the appearance of hypothyroid symptoms upon withdrawal of treatment may be interpreted as further proof that the patient's underlying problem really is hypothyroidism after all. Thyroid is therefore restarted and perhaps the dose even raised, and a vicious upward spiraling cycle is started, which may go on for years. Now, I would like to move rather rapidly to the question of adrenal therapy. The fact that ovarian dysfunction is a common finding in patients with disorders of the adrenal cortex has been recognized since the very earliest descriptions of these conditions. Patients with adrenal cortical hyperplasia or tumors of the adrenal cortex, as has been pointed out, are almost always anovulatory. The characteristic feature in these conditions is the increased production of androgen. And when the excessive production of androgen is corrected, ovarian function usually returns to normal. The clearest example of a situation in which increased adrenal androgen interferes with ovarian function is the so-called congenital virilizing adrenal hyperplasia, or the congenital adrenogenital syndrome. Now, in the congenital adrenogenital syndrome, there is an enzymatic defect whereby the adrenal gland is incapable of performing 21-hydroxylation, so that there is a block in the production of cortisol. The 17-hydroxyprogesterone then is shunted toward the production of further androgens, and the level then rises. The increased androgens produced by the abnormal adrenal then act back on the pituitary and shut off the secretion of gonadotrophic hormone, and this interferes then with the normal process of steroidogenesis in the ovary because there is no stimulus to it. The gonadotrophic hormone is shut off. Now, if we understand then what underlies this condition, it is relatively easy to see why cortisone is the specific therapy for this condition. When the cortisol production is decreased, there is a negative action on the pituitary gland with respect to ACTH feedback, and ACTH begins coming out at a very, very rapid rate. The ACTH mechanism is turned on in a futile effort to produce more cortisol, there being less cortisol available. But this only aggravates the problem. It drives the reaction further and further, producing more and more adrenals, and of course causes the adrenals to get bigger and bigger. When one gives cortisone, you suppress the increased amount of ACTH. The level of adrenal androgens returns to normal. This unlocks the block upon the gonadotrophic hormone production, and the normal ovarian steroidogenesis is brought into action. Now, after this, of course, estrogen production will go on. The patient will menstruate and eventually ovulate. So this is the classic example of the use of glucocorticoids to correct ovarian dysfunction. Now, while the adrenogenital syndrome due to adrenal hyperplasia may begin in utero, it may also sometimes begin in childhood, and not infrequently, the adrenals first begin to secrete excess androgen at the time of or shortly after puberty. In these instances, the condition is referred to as the acquired adrenogenital syndrome. These individuals experience normal sexual development and have a normal menarche. Usually shortly thereafter, they begin to develop progressive hirsutism of masculine distribution, acne, sometimes clitoral hypertrophy and muscular body build, and irregularity of their menstrual periods. They develop anovulatory menstrual cycles and oligomenorrhea, and sometimes become completely amenorrheic, and their 17-ketosteroids are elevated. They respond well to corticoid therapy, just as in the congenital type. Now, the problem here is that while one can demonstrate a specific enzymatic defect in the child with the congenital adrenogenital syndrome, this is not always possible in the young woman with the acquired type. This sometimes gets us over into the gray zone of mild or maybe. In the severe case, the woman with a 17-ketosteroid of over 25, I don't think this is really a problem. I don't think that anyone doubts that the hirsute woman with a 17-ketosteroid of 30 is not ovulating because her adrenals are producing too much male hormone. And her prompt response to corticoid therapy, as far as I'm concerned, attests to the true nature of her problem. Where many of us become a little uncertain is the case with the 17-ketosteroids, or let us say 17 to 20. The patient is a little hirsute, and she is oligomenorrheic. Is this a, quote, mild acquired adrenogenital syndrome who is best treated with cortisone, or is it something else in which some other therapy is indicated? These are patients who, under psychological stress, secrete excess ACTH, which drives their adrenals to produce excessive androgens. and they will sometimes develop rather striking degrees of hirsutism. If you follow these patients for long periods of time with repeat 17-ketosteroid determinations, you can sometimes actually see the ups and downs in their 17 ketos as they vary with degrees of stress. You can suppress their ACTH with corticoids and keep their ketos in the normal range, and as a result, you can control the hirsutism and improve menstrual cyclicity. Another large group of these patients with borderline high 17 ketos are undoubtedly individuals in whom the problem is actually due to a disturbance in steroidogenesis in the ovary rather than the adrenal gland. Remember that the steroidogenic pathways in the ovary and adrenal cortex are, for all intents and purposes, identical. The classic example of this is the abnormal steroidogenesis in the polycystic ovary. Now, theoretically, one would not expect that cortisone would do anything at all to improve the situation if the ovary and not the adrenal were the offending organ. But fortunately or unfortunately, this is not always the case. And it is this which makes the entire problem of corticoid therapy for ovarian dysfunction so difficult to understand. So let us see where we stand on our indications for corticosteroid therapy. The adrenogenital syndrome, we all would certainly agree on. In the Stein-Leventhal syndrome, there certainly seem to be some patients who respond to cortisone, but our own experience is that those patients who do respond to steroid therapy are most likely to be those who have top normal or slightly elevated ketosteroids. Those patients with normal 17 ketosteroids who are treated with cortisone, not infrequently, will show a single ovulation shortly after initiation of therapy, but will then lapse back into anovulation. And this is the more characteristic response in our experience. If the patient happens to conceive with this ovulation, well and good. But our experience with long-term corticoid therapy for this condition has not been extremely encouraging, and we prefer to use clomiphene, or in selected cases, wedge resection. Now, what about other types of ovarian dysfunction related to hypogonadotropism? While cortisone therapy may work in some cases, and it may be good to realize that one has this therapeutic tool among your bag of tricks, we have been more impressed with other modalities, such as low-dosage estrogen or clomiphene. And we have found these to be more reliable in these cases. Again, I am sure that there are those who would like to debate this point. I think I would be remiss if I did not mention one particular type of gonadotropin disturbance, which has recently been reported to respond quite well to corticoid therapy. This is the post-pill amenorrhea, the persistence of anovulation following discontinuation of oral contraceptives. Presumably, the problem here is that the centers responsible for gonadotropic hormone release have been suppressed for so long that they simply fail to come on again when the drug is discontinued. We recognize that this is a very mild gonadotropin dysfunction, which is not particularly difficult to treat, although admittedly it can be quite upsetting to the patient. It usually responds, for example, to low-dosage estrogen and just about always responds to clomiphene. Dodek and Kotz were the first to report the successful response of such patients to therapy with prednisone, and this observation has recently been confirmed by others. I think one interesting point that this raises is exactly how does cortisone work to enhance ovarian function. In the adrenogenital syndrome, it seems clear that it works by suppressing ACTH production, but what about in these other types of ovarian dysfunction where the adrenal function is normal? There are several possibilities. Cortisone may directly stimulate gonadotropic hormone release by some mechanism entirely related to its ACTH feedback, and there are many who strongly suspect this. It may also work by altering ovarian sensitivity to the gonadotropins, or it may work by affecting steroidogenesis in the ovary. The true answer to this question is, of course, presently unknown. Now, finally, a word about the choice of corticoid preparation and the dosage schedule. In general, cortisone is the drug of choice, certainly in the adrenogenital syndrome. A dose of 10 to 20 milligrams in divided dose is usually sufficient. I must admit that in patients with mild adrenogenital syndrome, we usually have become accustomed to using prednisone in this particular category of patient, generally in a dose of 2.5 milligrams TID. But this is a case we are not going to treat the patient for the rest of her life, as in the congenital adrenogenital syndrome. We generally treat them for 12 to 14 months and then stop steroid therapy. If the 17 ketosteroids have remained well suppressed during this entire time, these patients will often continue to do well on their own, maintaining a normal 17 ketosteroid level and continuing to ovulate. We check the ketosteroid level every 3 to 4 months, And if the ketones start to rise again, we simply place them back on steroid therapy for a while.
Pertinent to his discussion, Dr. Traum answers now a number of questions raised by Jefferson's G. Michael.
What are the normal values of PBI in pregnancy, and what thyroid test would you use on a patient who is pregnant or on the pill?
For the PBI in pregnancy, we like to see a PBI of at least 6 micrograms per cent. And on the upper end of the scale, we can see them go up sometimes, occasionally as high as 12 micrograms per cent, usually around 10. So about 6 to 10 micrograms per cent would be the accepted PBI after, let's say, the 6 week of pregnancy. As for the thyroid test in pregnancy, the PBI is still a very useful test. You simply have to be aware of the fact that because of the increased amounts of circulating estrogen, the PBI is expected to be higher. But, of course, all of the thyroid tests in pregnancy are greatly hampered by the effects of estrogen. It's kind of difficult to really know exactly what the thyroidal status of the patient is in pregnancy if you haven't followed her ahead of time. But I tend to be reassured if the PBI falls within that range.
Dr. Traum, how long do you continue prednisone if conception occurs, and is dose reduced stepwise?
The patient, let's say, who has an acquired adrenogenital syndrome, who's induced to ovulate with prednisone, well, I would generally continue corticoid therapy throughout this patient's pregnancy. This will mean that by the end of her pregnancy, if she's been pregnant for 9 months and maybe taken a couple of months to become pregnant, that she will have been on corticoid therapy approximately a year at that time. So I find this is a convenient time for me to taper the patient off of prednisone after parturition, and then get her off of it within a couple of weeks thereafter, and then keep her off the drug until maybe 6 or 8 weeks postpartum when I recheck her 17 ketosteroid value. And then I handle her the same way as I would the patient who hadn't conceived. As I said, following her with her keto value every 3 to 4 months. As long as it remained normal, I would continue to just follow her.
Thank you, Dr. Traum. Returning to the microphone now, Dr. Alvin R. Goldfarb, in his own unique manner, discusses his program of how to manage the climacteric patient.
Well, first of all, I'm convinced that a history and physical, including PAPs, are very important. This is a one time in life that a female needs reassurance. She's reached that decade in life where her children are teenagers, they're not at home anymore, her husband is busy, he's not around. They have nothing to communicate about. There is a loss and a lack of interpersonal relationships in the marriage. They had their children for so many years, and hubby was out in the world and he was going all the way over to the right, and poor Mrs. Jones was stuck in the house. And she doesn't know what to talk to him about anymore because the children have left. So that we must try to prevent this situation from developing. I think empathy, I don't think sympathy. I think any physician that gives a patient sympathy is ridiculous. You've lost control of the situation once you become sympathetic. Understanding, yes, but not sympathetic. They need reassurance. And these two points to me are most important. There must be individualization of treatment. No two horses are alike. But since we're talking about females, I presume I should say no two cows are alike. And they need individual attention. And then from a steroidal standpoint, which is what you're all waiting for me to talk about, what kind of steroids do I use and how do I use them? I divide my patients up into three groups. The premenopausal or perimenopausal patient, the menopausal patient, who is the female who has had her last menstrual period within the last 2 years, and the postmenopausal lady is the lady who is 2 years beyond the climacteric. And before we get to steroidal therapy, there are some other rules of the game that I would like to leave with you. Counseling for better living. Now, what I mean is that the individual should have a certain amount of self-respect for themselves, they should feel wanted, they should feel useful, and they should use their talents, not only as a homemaker, but they should now use these talents in the whole community. Their responsibilities for motherhood have left them, and it's very difficult on consultations in the office to get women to accept the fact that the good Lord gives you a treasure, but you must be intelligent enough to let this treasure bloom by itself. All you do is guide it, but you can't live the life of your kids. And it's amazing how many women are not willing to accept this. And I think it's a role, from the social standpoint, that the physician has to play in the consultation room. These are things that they want to hear about and talk about. Antidepressants. Yes, I use antidepressants, but I'm very leery of the depressed climacteric female. And if you sit and talk to her, 80% of them have been in psychotherapy before. They are individuals who have been having depressive reactive states all their lives, and I can predict which lady's going to have this problem. She's the woman who had dysmenorrhea when she was a teenager. She got married, developed dyspareunia, infertility, menstrual dysfunction. When she got to the fourth decade of life, she had the most miserable premenstrual tension syndrome in the business. And now that she's 45, nobody loves her anymore. You can bet your bottom dollar she's going to blame everything on the climacteric when this has been present all her life. And no one has ever taught her to recognize it before. Tranquilizers. Well, if you're going to give them antidepressants, Tofranil, Melaril, you better give them Librium when they go to sleep at night, otherwise they'll climb the walls. So you got to combine Tofranil with Librium. At least this is what I do. Psychotherapy, if they tell me they want to kill themselves, that's a sign that they need psychiatric help. I am afraid of any menopausal woman who has suicidal tendencies. And these are difficult things to treat, the involutional melancholia. Then there are some women who don't want hormones. And they say, but these flashes and flushes are bothering me. Daytime sedatives. We use a lot of Bellergal in that type of patient. Phenobarb and Belladonna, works lovely. One tablet TID. Very simply, in the perimenopausal female, who I feel requires substitutional hormonal therapy, she would require it for several reasons. Number one, menstrual dysfunction. The hypermenorrhea, polymenorrhea. But none of my patients get substitutional hormonal therapy at this epoch in life because of excess bleeding unless I've done a D&C. This is because I'm a gynecologist. I had the privilege of being in Boston last week with the American College of Physicians, and I raised the devil with these guys. And I'm sure they're internists in the audience. Don't put them on hormones in this age in life until you've ruled out pelvic disease. And if the patient at this age in life would like to use sequential therapy, which is the only thing I will use at this age in life, I will not use cyclic combined, fine. I then tell her she can stay on it, and she's got a built-in contraceptive, and she's delighted. And then she says, how long can I stay on it? And I say, well, a couple of years. She's now 45, and doctor, can I come off my sequential therapy? I said, fine. And then she'll say, you know, Dr. Goldfarb, what are my chances of getting pregnant now? And I'll say, oh, about 1 in 10,000. And she'll say, oh, no, I'll stay another couple of years. She stays on it another couple of years. She's now up to 48, and she says, well, Goldfarb, I think I've had enough. I want off. I say, fine. And she leaves the consultation room, and she turns around and says, but what are my chances of getting pregnant now? And I'll say, oh, about 1 in 18,000. Well, I better stay on it a little longer. She comes back at age 50, and she's now been on substitutional therapy at this age in life for 7 years. Again, what are my chances of getting pregnant? Oh, about 1 in 40,000. Well, Dr. Goldfarb, what is the oldest you have ever delivered a patient? And when I say 56, this lady wants sequential therapy forever, you see. Now, I make this point purely because I don't know if this is right. I do think that this lady has to be followed carefully, and once you start her on sequential therapy at age 43, you have to follow them. I don't know how long they should stay on it. I really don't. I'm developing a group from an investigational standpoint that have now been on it 5 or 6 years, and maybe a decade from now I can answer the question more intelligently. The menopausal lady who develops symptoms, who requires substitutional hormonal therapy, I also feel should have bleeding, should be bled off. Again, I will use sequential therapy. Now, the postmenopausal lady, on the other hand, is a different story. If she comes in with symptoms requiring treatment, there is great room for debate. I hear we'll probably go to low dosage estrogen therapy. Premarin 0.6, Stilbestrol 0.1, 0.2. 3 weeks on, 1 week off for a couple of cycles to see whether there's any spotting or staining. And then I might then put them on continuous low-dosage estrogen therapy. Now, if I have made this decision intellectually honestly to use continuous estrogen in a postmenopausal female, I think this is a woman who needs estrogen therapy for the rest of her life. And to me, the one woman that needs estrogen therapy for her entire life is the woman who has atrophic vaginitis and dyspareunia. This female has a sexuality that has to be treated so she can function as a woman in a marriage. And it might interest the audience to know that sexuality in females is a heck of a lot higher as they get older, and us old-timers get weaker and weaker and weaker. And I've been asked the question about what are we going to do for the post-climacteric male? And I can't answer the question because I know of nothing that's being done. Now, I have said many things. I have not answered questions, I've raised more questions. But I think I can answer 2 points. Number one, you must individualize treatment. Number two, that in the postmenopausal female who I think needs estrogen therapy, she needs it for the rest of her life. In my hands, gynecologic abnormalities account for the greatest use of hormones. I don't treat the female by the vaginal smear at this age in life. I don't treat her by alteration in cholesterols. I don't treat her with hormones because she has psychosomatic complaints, and I'm very afraid of the depressed involutional melancholia, and I think this is an individual in whom hormones will never help.
Thank you, Dr. Goldfarb, and our thanks too to Jefferson Medical College for cooperation in distributing these discussions. Your next issue, Doctor, a special report from the just concluded annual meeting of the American Medical Association held in San Francisco. Audio Digest Obstetrics and Gynecology is a biweekly service of the Audio Digest Foundation as a nonprofit subsidiary of the California Medical Association. All rights are reserved.